You are listening to
Worldwide Engineering.
Worldwide Engineering.
Worldwide Engineering.
Worldwide Engineering.
Hello, Worldwide Engineering. Hope you're doing well today. You know, one of the missions we have at Worldwide Engineering is to remind you that the world needs you. The world needs you for your unique skill set. It needs you for your ambition and for your drive. It is a passion you possess that's going to enable us to solve some of the world's largest problems we are facing today. Which is why I thought of sharing a table conversation I've had with the co-founders of Midday Squares that will serve you as an inspiration of building something great that has the potential to change the world. When I tell you that this conversation was one of the most inspiring conversations I've had for a while, I'm not over-exaggerating. Midday Squares is a Canadian food and beverage company best known for its functional chocolate bars. I've known Midday Squares and its co-founders for a while now. And what's really inspiring is that in only 3 years, they've managed to build a multi-million dollar startup with an extremely loyal fan base. And they now have their products in the Canadian and in the US market. And they were able to do this in one of the world's most competitive industries in the world. Just think about the food and beverage industry. Think about some of the biggest players that dominate this industry. Think about Coca-Cola. Think about Nestle. Think about PepsiCo. It's a completely saturated industry dominated by big players that have funding. But Midday Squares was able to enter the market and really build a brand that's currently thriving. In today's episode, you're about to learn from the three co-founders of Midday Squares what was their process building a thriving startup like Midday Squares. You're about to learn from their successes. What are some of the things they did right? What are some of the strategies they've used that have actually worked? What are some of the processes they've integrated in their company to automate their manufacturing plant? And you're also going to learn some of their failures and the challenges they've had to overcome. And that's something I want to emphasize on because the best lessons you're going to get are actually from failures and not from successes. This was definitely a more dynamic format than what you're used to listening to our podcast. In total, we had 5 different people on the show. The first 3 people were the co-founders of Midday Squares. Leslie Carls, who is responsible for the operations of the company and of the manufacturing plant. The second person was Jake Carls, who's actually the brother of Leslie Carls and is responsible of customer success and customer experience. And the third person you're about to hear is Nick Saltarelli, who is responsible of the logistics as well as the finances of the company. The last 2 voices were mine and that of my partner, Chiara Lucursi, who is actually the strategist behind Worldwide Engineering. To give you an intro to the conversation you're about to hear, I started the conversation by asking them how did the pandemic affect their business, which actually had a devastating effect on it. Anyways, people, with that said, I'll be seeing you on the other side. So then one question, how were you able, because at some point you weren't able to have so many employees in the factory. Did it slow down your production process?
No, we actually, because we're food, we were part of the exemption from the start. So we actually were allowed to have our full team in the plant. We just had to have a COVID safety procedure, right? So we needed to have split the lunches up. You know, there was masks that needed to be worn, you know, a different sanitation process, but basically just increased, you know, GMPs and sanitation. We're already a raw product, so I know it's weird, like people say, oh, bars are, you know, it's not as dangerous as dairy and meat, but we're actually right in the dairy and meat because we're raw in the sense that we don't cook our product. So any bacteria that can, let's say, live on the bar doesn't get killed by high heat or super, super cold
pressure.
Mm-hmm. So we have to be extra careful in our sanitation process.
Can I mention something to you guys? So something that actually kept us from, you know, laying off anyone or, you know, during that time, because we didn't lay off one person, which is rare, which is something.
How's that goal?
We've actually hired.
We're still hiring.
But I think that during the time we discussed March, it was a tough month. It was a 2-week really crash down. What really saved us during a time, and it's actually really cool to see, was actually the frontline teams. Mm-hmm. We worked very closely with the frontline team across Canada, and we supplied them bars, which allowed us, our manufacturing team, to keep manufacturing a lot, even though we were losing a ton of retail sales at the time. So it kind of it gave that shift to cover it. And I, you know, A, they're heroes, but you know, they also kind of saved us and indirectly through keeping our team employed.
Yeah, we structured a cost deal with them. So we just, the deal was what we said to them is like, you buy it at cost, and our main goal is to keep the line running.
And they love that. Running, they love the idea of supporting.
And that's it.
Of supporting.
It was a win-win.
And we also came together, like we decided as a team, like at Midday Squares, we're a family. Like we work double as hard to keep the culture and the people around. And I remember at one point we spoke about many different ways if we, instead of laying people off, of how to support our team, whether it was the whole team taking a pay cut and dispersing the money equally. Like we spoke about many different options to make sure that we didn't lay one person off. And we even actually Ubered our team for 3 months back and forth from work to home every day.
Which was extraordinary cost, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it was, could have been $30,000.
You know, it goes down to the Amazon model of long-term thinking, not short-term thinking. And I think I was a guy that loved the Walmart model a lot more than the Amazon model
in the past. What's the Walmart?
What I mean by that is I like the idea that the physical operation, the old school mentality that Walmart had to building a business, they had all the ground game, they built the stuff. And I never looked at Amazon as this empire, which they really looked at and kind of always let me know about these different things that Amazon was doing and their leadership team. And what I did was I was kind of like ignoring it. You know when you don't want to hear other things? You know, I was like that, and I really loved Walmart. I was like, Walmart. And then I just started reading this book called it's Jeff Bezos' letters that he writes, but they're interpreted, right? And it starts to show how great of a company and mindset that they have to growing and building team culture, making sure their team stays. And it started to align with a lot of things that Midday Squares was doing. So I was kind of like, holy shit, we're checking a lot of these check marks. And
because I was secretly pushing your agenda.
So a lot of things he was saying was actually that very similar agenda. And then when I finally read it and kind of like actually was willing to openly hear about it, I start saying, oh my God, I'm fucking amazed, excuse my language. And what happened with that was now it's like, you could like two, you know, you don't even like one or the other.
Yeah.
I think that's a big thing. And kind of the way that Jeff talks about how he works with his team, builds the culture, is very much how we're doing it. So a lot of the stuff that they were making decisions on at the beginning, cost-wise, were very costly. The Ubers, the other things that we did, a lot of the GMPs, other type of stuff were very expensive. To me, it was like, okay, but how do we justify this on P&Ls and stuff like that, like that he's working on?
Mm-hmm.
But it has nothing to do with that, because at the end of the day, you keep a good team,
they'll come back.
They're coming back. Like, and talk about this week.
Basically, I think exactly like with COVID, I think our team saw how much we put them forward.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we always talk about if you respect and care for people, they will come back for you and they'll be there for you. Not everybody. Right? The world is a bit of, you know, people are not really reliable, but we do have people that are reliable. And yeah, I mean, if I tell my team we have to do a graveyard shift, like from 6:30 p.m. to 7 a.m., there's not a bad vibe, not a complaint, not a fate, nothing.
So that's
how you
call
were
it.
There.
A
graveyard
shift.
Through the night. Through the night. And they actually did it with like a smile on their face.
They show up, like rallying, like,
you
let's
saw
go.
Video
like,
content
yeah.
of them showing up
yeah.
fired.
We're gonna release
like
this video, but I will say, if you're not reliable, you don't last long at Midday Squares.
Zero.
Yeah.
We have fired 70 people since we started Midday Squares. It's 2.5 years old.
Between production and front
office. Between production and front
office. I'm proud of that.
Yeah, but that narrative isn't telling the true story.
No.
There's a reason why you fired. And we're building a foundation.
We're building a culture.
In the foundation.
If you don't fit in the foundation, you're done.
I always
there's
say.
There's a saying. There's this quote, I think. It's hire slow, fire fast.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know,
I love
it's about.
That.
Yeah, it's about, and a lot of times it's not necessarily about the skill set that doesn't fit. It's a lot of time the culture, especially that you guys, and it's one of the reasons Karen and I fell in love with the company. It's a lot of times it's the culture. It's what the brand
stands for.
And you know, I'm glad you guys brought up the topic of leadership, because that's something Karen and I are really into. We're really into leadership, and it is a good leader that will either make or break a company during tough times. And that's kind of something that we've been seeing lacking in 2020 in the times of crisis, and which is resulting in all those problems that the world is facing as a whole, is that a leader has a capacity to, how do you say, to navigate the entire team, the country, the company, whatever it is.
The influence.
The culture through tough times. So I want you guys to take us back to mid-March, when everything was shutting down.
Oh.
Where
your phone,
supply... Your supply chains the trucks that were delivering supplies, fresh supplies to your office.
Raw materials.
Take us back to that day. How were you feeling?
Can I kick us off?
Yeah, and then I think we all felt differently. So I think it's important that we go through those feelings and how important that is to have a strong partnership.
Yeah, I think we're going to dance a lot through this. I'm just going to kick us off and let it go.
Kick it.
That's true.
She was in Peru when it all hit. Like
working on supply chain.
She was in Peru working on supply chain. And that was already a deadly moment because we had a crisis in our supply chain prior to this even happening, which was in our, we use Satcha Inchi in our product, which is a product that comes from Peru that you really can't get anywhere else in the world, right? So she's there and she was coming to the airport to come back home when it all broke, that the whole fucking country was shutting down. And at this point, we were just stressed to make sure that she was able to get back into Canada. And then she gets back into Canada, and it was like
I had to quarantine.
She
for 14
had to quarantine,
days, which he did have as well.
But then
he was with me.
Yeah, exactly. So we end up sitting there 14 days. But now shit, as we're quarantining, is exploding.
Yeah, because and Jake had to take the reins. He's handles different things in the business, so that was very intense for him as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll
with the new plant manager at that point in time, that wasn't a right fit. The leadership wasn't there, and so at the end of the day he's there navigating everybody, we're on fucking television screens.
What
trying
were his
to
roles actually like a plant manager, and then what else was he doing, because you have
yeah what are your
like,
official
what was
topics
he doing at that
your
point,
official
like...
position.
So I was doing what I do best, to be honest with you, and I think I actually held the spirits of the team together for
wow.
I was like relentlessly optimistic for like the first 3 months, like hardcore, like you don't understand. Like I was so excited about this, not from the public health crisis, from bringing the team together, keeping everyone's energy up. And I was trying as hard as I can. I was releasing so much energy, making people happy during that time that I actually broke down to the worst part of my life. Actually,
yeah.
I felt the lowest I've ever felt. And I had to see serious therapy, our therapist, our business therapist, James Gavin, helped me really get through this and realize I need to be a dreamer again. I lost all my dreaming. I lost my purpose. And this is because I gave so much of that time when I had to, but not from an operational standpoint, from a spirit standpoint. And when they were 2 week quarantined during a complete crisis that's never been seen before in the last 100 years, I had to help them navigate, you know, certain options, you know, operational things that I've never done in the business before. I don't touch anything with manufacturing. I don't touch anything with any of the operational stuff. I could help with the marketing and the sales stuff, but that wasn't what was important at the time.
You don't even need that.
The team was scared, especially the manufacturing team, because at the same time, they're going to be in close proximity of each other. Like, they're manufacturing, mm-hmm. right? They were really scared. And the fact that I wasn't there, because I'm their leader, really made them worried. Because they're like, why is she home? And we're here. And so at one point, that was very
stressful
because, you know, I'm a person, I'll sleep in the plant. Like, I will sleep in the plant and I will be there with them no matter what. And when they saw me having to stay home, that's when they got really concerned. And it was on Jake to make them feel that confident that that's
transferring that information now to the operational team where he can air traffic control what needs to get done and systems to be built. And that's what we've done in the last 8 months. We've built a lot more systems, we've hired more people, we've grown the actual team, and our strategy's changed.
Yeah,
we built our own ERP
COVID.
System, so we don't use NetSuite. NetSuite or SAP. It's like
Nick's been building systems for the last 8 months.
Wow.
with our developer.
Yeah, so
if you don't mind explaining what it is for.
Yeah, so what we decided on is that we used, instead of using a typical SQL database, we went with, do you guys know Airtable?
No.
So Airtable, yeah. For everybody listening, it's phenomenal. So Airtable is the Photoshop of databases. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So they've democratized the ability to visualize and interact with an SQL database. It's fascinating the level of architecture that you can get when you get into that database. So what we chose was that we were going to use Airtable as our database. And the reason why we chose Airtable, even though it's more costly, is that every single person, that whether you have software engineering background or not, can interact with the database in the way that we want to do that. So we chose that. Then Airtable out of the box comes with the most incredibly robust API that is built for you. So as you're building tables in the database, it's automatically populating the API with the exact table codes in it. So you don't even have to go and queue it up. It's there. Literally, if your table's called Nick and your object is hi, Nick.i is one of the API calls, okay? Right, like it's that simple out of the gate. So we use that. We built a front end on Heroku. Okay. It's called middaysquares.heroku.com. That speaks directly to the API from Airtable. And we just started going. And we went, built a system that is so robust that it tracks raw materials from the second they enter using QR codes. That's out of the gate with Airtable. So we scan everything in. Then that scan becomes the passport documentation for what we're doing. And the passport follows the raw materials throughout the journey. So that way, by the time those raw materials get processed in manufacturing, we're actually now able to know as we ship products out exactly what lot numbers were in that product to do the recall.
Could trace the product.
Yeah, and because Airtable is so robust in being able to go backwards, once we saw the power of it, we just said, let's keep going.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, we had an ERP system, an entire ERP system. And that ERP system cost us less than $800 a month to manage.
That's fascinating. So
you know,
now,
I'm glad.
So now you're able to forecast your raw materials, forecast your demand.
Not just forecast. I mean, the system's so robust that it's down to the area where it predicts the ending of raw materials in the warehouse and actually can write its own PO. So
so it automatically orders things for you.
We're not at the order yet, but it generates its own PO, and then it has to get signed off by someone. And then there's rules in there. If above 10 Gs, who does it need to be signed off by? If lower, so it's pretty interesting.
That's cool.
And then the last step would be for it to send its own POs directly to the suppliers.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you bring that up because it was one of those things that I once heard. Probably Les was talking about this on Midday Square on Instagram. She was in the process of automating the factory. Yeah. You went to Germany at some point to learn about machines. You got them shipped to Canada. And it was one of those things I heard and I was like, you know what, those guys, we could pull up a very interesting podcast about that, you know, because it's a lot of times it's less talked about. Like, we all see chocolate bars, but we forget the back end, that how much work, how much machines, how much engineers it takes to engineer the perfect chocolate bar.
Yeah.
So can you take us through your journey, you know, going to Germany and automating? How was the journey for
before
you?
Before she gets into that, just because it's important, 1,000 people, roughly, in every single bar that you eat, 1,000 people will have touched that supply chain, almost. So if we go back to the farms, if we go back to each one of the raw materials, the transport, about 1,000 people in every bar, just to give you the complexity of getting a $2.99 bar to market.
It's very similar to Nespresso when we source the coffee cherries, where they come from, who touches them, manufactures them, puts them in
so
the box,
cool.
marketing and all that.
Right. Yeah. So many people.
1,000 fucking people. Yeah. You know how many people that is?
We should start talking about that more.
Yeah, I know.
The reason you brought that up, but like, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think it says a lot, right?
You can make a nice piece of video.
Yeah,
like that.
It's a story.
It's $3.99 for 1,000 people.
It's crazy, but
kick
so
it off.
Get into the complexity of what we built.
Yeah, I think when we started, we were obviously, making the product in the condo, the three of us, and it was in an 8x8 pan. And I remember when we had to scale up that 8x8 pan to, I think it was 14x14 or something.
How many bars is that 8x8? I think six bars at a time.
It made 8 bars.
That's so pathetic.
16 squares.
You were very strict during that
very
time.
Strict.
I really didn't like you.
Yeah, you fought a lot.
No, her and I, she'd have me
you
at 6
weighing
in the
morning.
Yeah, she had me at 6 a.m. every day at their condo. and it smelled like cocoa. It literally like light cocoa at first, but then when you overuse it.
I'm desensitized.
She would say, I get there. It wasn't even like a hi, how are you? It was like, okay, you ready for the salt? So then she'd make me sit. Imagine, just sitting.
Wasn't waiting salt. Fast enough. Let's go.
She'd be like, you're so slow. And then I wouldn't talk to her the rest of the day because I was like, I can't deal with this type of animosity. And then what would happen? Obviously, we would work it out. You know, we love each other. But
it was miserable times.
It was miserable for all of us.
In retrospect, it was miserable.
Every chapter of Midday Squares has its miserable moments.
I just, it was a great memory. And you know, whenever I'm kind of post-traumatic stress from it. So like if I ever have to, sometimes I have to go into the factory when we really need like late, something late. And I do it, I kind of like get this weird envision of Leslie being like, it's not fast enough. So continue.
Man, it was so messed up just before you go. Because there's so much to unpack before you even get into that bit. We would start production at 7 a.m, okay?
Horrible.
But wait, every single morning, we had to, as things were getting there, we would take anywhere from 45 to 100 Polaroids.
With an Instapax.
With an Instamax.
That's awesome, fucking.
Oh my God.
No, and write the note. We had to Google, we had to search people's names, see what they liked. Because back in the day, we were really custom messages. Like, you know, tell Charlie we say hi, like XOXO MDS. Like, we were going full out, and we were dressing up too.
That song, I Feel the Beat.
That got us through it.
We had a lot of moments. I walked out a bunch of times.
You ran out and you
in the rain.
She's like, he's like, let her go.
Yeah. I was done.
And then we hit on your personal relationships too.
Then we would go at 3 p.m. and spend 5 hours in a car every fucking day.
Delivery.
And then it got to the point where we had to be in different cars, so we weren't even together having conversations. You're just in a fucking car.
We were taking a cart down to Canada Post.
They started denying us.
We're like, you can't ship through here anymore. Like, they were getting pissed.
Too much. We would show up, guys, with 200-300 boxes.
And they would go mental. Cut it. But I think it's important that we went in the car together at the beginning. We would go from, it was actually 5 p.m. till about 10 p.m. I thought it was okay to ring doorbells at 10 p.m. They would take me, they would let me go, and I would go ring the doorbell. And then I'd
be invited in.
I'd go inside, sit inside, and they'd be waiting in there like this.
I actually have post-traumatic stress. Like, I'm feeling it right now when you say
that.
I would never do it again.
That's what I'm saying. Always remember day one, right? And those were the days, like, honestly.
I'll never do it again.
We don't have the energy to do it again.
I just wouldn't do it.
I don't even have that energy to go sit in this
house.
Continue on.
So we were identifying, okay, how do we scale up from our 8x8 pan to a bigger tray and not, you know, mess with the integrity of the recipe?
How many bars were you making? Like
just
the
at the beginning, eight bars, like
per
every
tray?
Hour. Yeah,
every hour. So
like a big day was what?
We
64
were so backed
bars?
Up. Yeah, we were so backed up because I was making the chocolate by hand and the dough. We were like
telling the massage story. You had to.
I had to
pay for a masseuse to come at night to get her back in shape for the next day.
I permanently messed up my wrists.
Because
my arms were swollen from all the stuff. Yeah, because it was so the dough, the chocolate, the rolling in the small tray like that. You're going like that. Your
wrists
are done. So, anyways, all to say, so we reached out to a welder, and no welder could get us the tray made in time. We needed it, like, we were back up, I'm telling you.
Yeah,
we'd start hiring people in our condo. We couldn't keep up. We needed a bigger tray. It wasn't making sense. So, and I was basically the only person who could really make the product properly at the time. So, it was crazy. So, we scaled up. We found a welder who we still work with today. He's incredible, and a machinist. So, he made us our first tray, our first custom tray, with, 316 stainless steel, food grade, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So, that was our first, like, scaling up production.
This is, I think, really, because we're on an engineering podcast, this is the most, I think, important piece is that first principles thinking took us through the whole thing. So I want everybody to know, listening, that everybody told us, everybody that had PhDs, that were making products for 35 years, we went to go see over and over manufacturers, brilliant chocolate specialists, and everybody said, this product is not able to scale. You cannot make this at scale.
It's artisanal.
It's artisanal. You can't do this.
Really?
Even the way we made our chocolate, like from the company we bought our chocolate machine equipment from, when I showed up to the place in Europe to test the equipment, they're like,
you don't make chocolate this way.
In 100+ years of being like in this industry, we have never seen this way of making chocolate.
But
that's hilarious.
But Elon Musk, I think, really Yeah, it's just driven down the point of first principles thinking.
Yeah.
Is if you can map it out from core to a document and put thought on paper, then the probability of it being possible is very high.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you really are talking. Every time we would sit with investors or anything, and we'd go look at them, they'd look at us, and I said, no, you're not understanding. Focus on the fundamental truths. Here's the document that explains why this is going to be possible. Tell me why it's not going to be possible. And that's when everyone would go, I can't answer that question.
So basically, fast forwarding, we moved to a second kitchen from out of our condo, and we started scaling up the production, but still everything was manual. And we slowly,
what were your capacities then?
Oh, really low. We were probably making
100 bars a day.
Yeah, 100 bars a day.
At Beijing, it was a little more.
At Beijing, no. It's probably started off with 100. I'll tell you right now.
Yeah, we can go backwards on this. The condo, max capacity, one for sure, was less than 100 bars a day.
No, we were doing 1,600 bars a day, roughly, in Beijing.
At Beijing. Divided by 12, so we 10x.
Which is 133 boxes a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
We do that.
So now we do about 1,000 boxes a day by hand.
So every scale has 10x production. The condo, we went from 100. Then we went to the big kitchen. We 10x production to about 1,300. Then manually scaled from 1,300 to 10,000 bars a day. And now
not 100% manual. So we actually started bringing in machines
that we
slowly
designed.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Slowly at the beginning, there was just some machines that we were able to purchase and bring in. But our dough is so complex that some of the most basic machines that you need in a bakery, like dough mixers or processors or whatever, did not work with our dough. Because our dough is like rock hard. So basically what happens with our dough is we melt down our cocoa butter, so it's super malleable to use in the product, right? It's liquid.
Yes.
As soon as it starts solidifying at room temperature,
it's rock solid.
It becomes rock solid, right? The cocoa butter solidifies.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't process fast enough, you have a big problem.
Yeah.
So basically, that was the first challenge, is how do we take traditional baking equipment and figure out what we can use for our actual product, because it doesn't work. I remember we drove to Toronto, we went to baking specialists.
We went to Las Vegas.
We went to different trade shows all around the world to look at machines. And we basically, the only thing the trade shows did for us, because Nick and I did this together, was spark ideas on how we can manipulate the machinery that already exists.
Yes, that,
to
you just stole the word.
Manufacture our product. And so things that might not seem
even
like
be
anything
used
for food that you look at, we're like, that will work, mm-hmm. this will work. And then I remember we even flew in a specialized engineer from Florida. He's like the holy grail. He's built crazy stuff, engineered it.
I forgot about
Hans.
Yeah, I can't.
Yeah, Hans. He was nuts, man. So he came in.
So what did he do?
Came in. Him and I went in the plant. We started building, like, we were testing mini extruders. We were building molds. We were tracking air. He was like, and he couldn't get it. And he's like,
he couldn't figure it out.
That, I'm telling you, I am here to say that.
Don't
first,
break the table.
Yeah, you smack him. Sorry,
we're on a podcast.
Yeah.
So,
relax, man.
Yeah, I'm
he has
like,
a, he has
so
like a memory lane.
We love the excitement.
Yeah, no, because it's passion. We call it passion.
Passion,
yeah.
Exactly.
Passion. When we get hyped up, when we speak, when we fight or whatever, it's called passion.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, right? So Hans came and he basically said, like, no, like, either this is going to take us a very long time, but with what we've experienced, it won't work. So we went back to the table. I remember we were at the country house and you were lying on the couch and you were reading a book and I was like pacing and I'm like, I don't understand what we're going to do. And the budget started off really small.
Because of experts.
We worked with an engineering firm and then it ended up being double the amount.
No, but,
of what we budgeted.
You can't just say it, tell the story.
$1.4 million ended up being $2.8 million.
Yeah, and we had already applied and raised the money for the 1.4.
Yeah,
so
but before
big...
we get into the investment money back, because you know I'm sure they're going to want to hear about the automation,
yeah.
The process is. So we basically then were thinking about different ways to do it, and one day we woke up and we're like, "This is going to work," and this is after 4 months of me traveling around the world, shipping $30,000, $40,000 worth of raw materials to machine companies.
Oh, that was horrible.
To test. That's and horrible. I was, every day I would come back and I would be so discouraged. I'd tell Nick, Jake, it didn't work.
And we're burning through budget here. Eh? Like, we don't have, this is our money.
And while we were doing that, we were also working on a reformulation for our, one of our flavors. And actually, the trip in the USA was a breakthrough trip on the reformulation about the pumpkin seeds.
Yes.
But anyways, everything, something good comes from everything. But we had,
we had,
you know, had to, a lot of money went down the drain testing and trying to find what machines would work. And then finally we identified what was going to work. And then you go into the process, right? So let's say you want to go buy a Rolls Royce tomorrow. You go to the car dealership and you could test the Rolls Royce. Take it out for a drive. You know, it's a high ticket.
Try everything. Try everything for it.
Try everything, right? They roll the red carpet.
Make you coffee.
With machines, they're asking you to spend millions of dollars and you can't even see the machine or test it. You can test aspects of it. When you're building a machine that's customized to your product, it doesn't exist. There's no showroom. Mm-hmm. They might have a piece of something. They might have a version of a smaller version of the machine. Again, doesn't emulate 100% what your product is going to do on the equipment.
Let alone speak to other pieces of equipment on the line because it's not from the same company.
Exactly. So we have equipment from different pieces of companies, so it all has to communicate through the programming with each other. And we have 170 feet of equipment and machinery. And basically, I told Jake and Nick that we have to go forward and place POs on these machines, and I'm 90% sure they're gonna work, but there's a 10% chance that they won't work. Yeah, because we've only tested theoretically that this will work with, you know, I went to the machine shops and I used machines. The conveyors weren't even working. We had to pull the belt just to emulate what it would look like. And it was like, it was all messed up, the stuff. And I was like, this is going to work. And I really didn't give them much insight on what was going on because I knew that if I instilled fear that we wouldn't be able, Nick wouldn't be able to raise the money because he would be like, well, I need to know 100% is this going to work. Mm-hmm. And that's basically it. It took 1 year because we were super rushed to design the whole line, to test and everything, and to build a plant in 3 months. So 1 year from start of idea generation of how we're going to do this to it being in our plant. We basically started of April 2019, and we just passed 2020.
And so, you're using the automation now?
So we have installed the line, which was really horrible during Corona because we basically never installed a line before our entire life. We haven't even, let alone, you know, this is our first time seeing equipment like this. Yeah. And we had to install it. And basically, we are just now starting to learn how to use it. And training's about 3 months.
The good news is, though, we have seen squares come off the line.
Yes, we have.
Yay!
Our capacity now goes technically 10x.
It's another 10. It's always a magnitude.
It's 90,000 in a 24-hour shift. So three shifts of 8 hours.
90,000
bars.
90,000 bars
in a full day shift.
In 3 8-hour shifts, so a 24-hour
day. In one day, you can run three shifts.
Oh, you guys are running?
Not right now, but we will be.
The capacity.
Which brings us to how much revenue through this plant, if we could reach to.
No, in theory, it's about $46 million that we can.
Just from Montreal.
But that goes back. Wait, I just want to say thing for the entrepreneurial spirit behind this, right? So when she says you could be 10% wrong,
it's a big risk.
It's not, but it's not. It's an asymmetric bet.
Yeah.
If we're wrong, we're wrong, and this journey is over.
It's over. Yeah.
But if we're right big.
Right.
We're right really big.
I like
You're
that.
Right. Yeah,
and,
I love that.
And, no, but it's the truth. It's asymmetric bet. And the downside's limited, but the upside is pretty much infinite.
You always got to know your risk, like, and accept the risk too. And you hit big, and either you hit or you don't. And we've accepted the loss of it not hitting.
We're okay with it all not working out.
I think it's important that we came at within, I think, a 1 year point five. We came together, the three of us, and we just sat there and we're
September,
like,
September, babe.
Was it September?
Yeah.
Okay.
September. MDS 2.0.
Oh yeah. Okay. MDS 2.0. We said we're going guns blazing, no matter what. Wait, but
we hit rock bottom.
Yeah, we hit all together. This is the first time all together we hit it together.
Same
so
time.
Usually we have one partner pulling two out of the well, but this time everyone was in the well at the bottom.
So how did you guys get out of rock bottom?
Yeah,
I think we were all tired of being scared.
Yeah,
fear was prevent fear
us. Of the failing.
Fear right now in the world is running it down. We came out and said, who the fuck cares whatever way is going? We're giving it 150% because if you're not going to give it 100%, then you fucked up. Because at the end of the day, we said to each other, we're going all out. If it goes left, which means it's over, or if it goes right, we're happy either way. And I'll tell you why. Obviously, we're more happy with the right way. But it's because we're giving every single little piece that we have to the business. And knowing that my partners, just this is a personal thing, knowing my partners are giving their 150%, I feel good.
Yeah, me too.
And I think we all just finally came together. Like, to give an example, we all held hands for the first time. First time all together at the full capacity.
Also, we do therapy twice a week.
Oh, yeah.
We work at the business therapy coach twice a week. We invest a lot of money in this. And it's helping making us machines, like beasts.
It's the only way we're here.
It's really making us face all the demons inside, and it's making us
unstoppable.
And it's the best thing we ever decided to invest in. Like Nick will always say about the P&L, having that on your P&L, it's the best.
It's the best thing. Our investors don't even say a peep.
Yeah.
You know, we see.
It's amazing.
Because at the end of the day, they're invested in a team, and if we
fall apart,
the whole thing falls apart. So when they go look at the P&L and the quarter, it's a fucking right. It's a business expense.
That's amazing.
But it's important you say at the beginning when we came into the partnership in August 2018, Nick said, we don't go forward with this partnership. The business, I'd rather even not start the business, to be honest, even though they did so much work previous to it. If we don't agree and accept and follow through, commit to seeing that coach once a week. And in my head, I was like, why?
Jake didn't believe in
because they were seeing he was seeing his past business and you were working with
and
him
I couldn't
as well,
get my partners in my last business to do
which
it
which is a big issue and he saw that was a failure in that sense and
that was my learning.
He's learned and he brought it to us and he said the only way we do this is if we do that. And in my head I told you, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Why the hell is he making me go sit with them two in a room to talk about things?
I could see that, why you would make that. Yeah.
But it was the best thing. I can tell you today, I preach it more than ever to every single person. I'm so passionate about it that like, I thank you. I actually thank you for it.
It's the hack. It's the hack. You're welcome. I thank you for trusting me on this one.
We have so many so many fragile dynamics in this partnership. Nick's my husband. Jake's my brother.
Brother-in-law wife.
Exactly. So we're family, right? You guys are in a relationship. Mm-hmm. So you can understand that how intense it is and how much you put on, how much you risk. Mm-hmm. And so that was why we committed to it, because we are risking so much. And it would be so sad at the end of this if we were made a lot of money and built a really successful company and made epic snacks for the world to feel good about, but we didn't feel good inside, and we weren't, let's say we had nothing left to do with each other.
Can I tell a really bold moment?
Yeah.
So at first when we started, like the first 8 months, I'm gonna say 8 months, I felt personally that they, every time I'd bring them a decision, I felt that because they were married, that there was a biased decision. And I could say today, I do not even feel a single peep. They've made me feel that, they've taken that whole fear and insecurity away from me completely. And we have fair decision making now, and it's like I don't feel that 2-1. And we haven't even discussed this. This is the first time ever. I think it'd be a great podcast for
us
to
hear.
It's good to hear that I finally.
Yeah,
for sure, that's a good inspiration.
It's true. I felt at the beginning that because they were married, and I think I voiced it to you maybe once.
Yeah, you did.
In therapy,
we had it.
That I felt more that it puts them in an uncomfortable position when you and I are, because you used to go at it a lot. Leslie and I used to go at it about different things, but it would create. I felt that he had no choice but to lean.
I was shown. That was so not the case. And because it wasn't the case, but because there's those dynamics, it comes out. And I felt that my brother was my partner in my last, we were four partners. And they would always use that against us. And I'm like, guys, I'm not agreeing with him because he's my brother. I'm
just business
fucking
first.
Yeah, that's how I, and especially coming from sports, that really was instilled in me. Like, I played competitive hockey. It was the fucking logo on the wall.
Yeah.
That's the team you play for.
Nothing else.
Nothing else. So I come from that school. So I actually would get very offended when people would tell me that I'm choosing sides with my brother or my wife or that, because I'm like, you don't know me as a person. I'm saying, you know, but now you're getting to know me. But this is not me. I want what's best for Midday Squares.
But those hard conversations have to happen. And like, you know, like those hard conversations would happen in the business therapy sessions where, if you, I think we have like some videos of it where these are bullets. Like, they're not, it's not a joke. I almost choked. I'm not a violent person either. Yeah. She, I almost choked her out one time. I think the business was on its was on the brink that time when we, her and I got into a massive fight. And
two times it was on the brink. Of,
but a full brink. Like a full brink.
Yeah.
I got to explain to you, like, it started in our office. The fight started. It started building between her and I. He walked into it and he tried to moderate. And at this time, I still felt that kind of like insecurity of like the bias. Mm-hmm. And then of their relationship versus the business, which I should never feel like that way. But, you know, now I feel really good about it. But now I could say proudly, I have zero or negative even feelings about that. And he walked in and he saw the passion of the energy of the power of that fight. And he said, he was about to break down. He said he called our therapist for an emergency authorization of a session.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to show up because I was already stepping out of the business in the sense where I can't work. I wasn't able to work with this because inside it feels you're actually you're falling apart.
Yeah.
And I showed up to gym. I called my therapist before I did a bold move. I called to prepare for what I was going to say to them in the conversation. So I didn't answer any of their calls.
We thought he wasn't showing up to the session.
No, we go to gym. I see Jim. I'm like, I don't think Jake's coming. And then he's like, he's already arrived.
And I was there for an hour and a half, getting ready to make my case. And it's not us versus them or me versus them. It's never. It was that feeling for me, unfortunately, before. Now it's us versus others, or us versus the problem that's happening, right? Yeah. Not, you know, and we could have ping pong. You know, you just use the statement ping pong. We all have rallies now.
We do,
Les and I had our first successful gym session without Jim. So we
Jim, but you don't mean Jim like
James.
Work
James out yeah, no, James, his name's
Jim.
Yeah,
Jim
Gavin. His name's Jim Gavin.
Okay.
I think another important piece is there's a lot of fraudulent advisors out there, or business coaches. Jim's a PhD in behavioral psychology, has years of experience in executive teams in the airline industry and mining industry. Still an active professor.
Legend.
He's a legend. He was introduced to us by the business coach of the CEO of Shopify.
Wow.
Said, this is, if you're in Montreal, this is the guy, and we got him. I haven't seen him for almost a decade now, but the guy's a machine. Yeah, the guy's a real machine.
So guys, right now, you right now covered the bottom of the bottom.
Mm.
Now my question to you, what is the next 10X move you're about to make?
Well, we're launching the US.
That's our 10X. Montreal is our backyard. Canada is our backyard. Mm-hmm. And it got us, it built our business. It really showed the product market fit. It showed that we could build a tribe. And this tribe is the strongest tribe, in my opinion, I'll say it confidently, that I've ever seen of the likes of like Lululemon has, in the sense of tribe and community. The US is our next step to figure out, and this is gonna be a hard thing for us because it's gonna be a difficult one, is how do we build the tribe there with the tribe here? And it's different cultures, they're different consumers, the retail game is very different, a lot of things are different, but we gotta be able to, with the limited resources we have, we're not Google here, you know, million. We will get there one, a good answer, not yet, I like that. But our complication is going to be 10X-ing this in the US and really winning that game, especially during a pandemic where you can't just go run and hug everyone. No. We like that grassroots stuff. We like building relationships. We have to figure out a new way to do that. And then from an op standpoint, I think getting the plant fully running to that 90,000 bars and new flavors and new products.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think for us, exactly like Jake said, is expanding to the US and really elevating on brand awareness, our podcast. And just continuing to build the structure of Midday Squares.
The piping.
We've hired a lot of people. We're continuing to hire. And I think the team that we're building now is the team that's going to take us to that next level of revenue. And I think that's, like Jake said, and then putting out a new snack a new flavor in 2021. And continuing to build the product lines.
And most importantly, your favorite thing that you've instilled in us, what is coming in the next couple of years?
Oh, the IPO,
I think it's important you explain to this podcast why the public market was of your interest and why you instilled it in Leslie and I.
Yeah, so, okay. And then if a side note, if you want to talk about it, modularity of our manufacturing structure versus monolithic manufacturing structures. So Kraft is monolithic, 100,000 square foot facilities, everything under one hood. We're taking the approach of micro facilities, so small build prices with high output. So that could be in near city destinations. So if you look at our facility, running cost
now, baby, when we have multiple product lines, it might change.
Yeah, 100%.
Micro on the midday square line.
Yeah, 110%. But $3.3 million to build almost $50 million of output—that is unseen ratios in manufacturing. Yeah. Usually, your manufacturing costs are 50 to 100 million when you look at what Kraft and those are doing. So that's an interesting subject matter. But the IPO is—I think a lot of people talk about the IPO being something that's like, you know, like IPO, we just want to do it. It's just really not the case. One, we don't want to sell this company to another company. That was never been our goal. And so when we were meeting our investors for the first round, was that the entire industry right now is set up for companies that are like us to build and sell to Kellogg's, General Mills, Hershey's. Like, we're talking like 10 companies, buy every single company, every single year. Yeah, but like clockwork. Mm-hmm. Company gets to $100 million in revenue, they're acquired for five. Company gets to $30 million in rent, they're acquired for 100. You just see it like clockwork.
Yeah.
And we absolutely don't want to do that. Like, so badly don't want to do that, because we really believe we have a shot at doing something special here. And so when we're telling our investors, well, okay, well, if you're going to invest in us, you can't flip us to another company. And so you have to expect to see liquidity in either us raising debt to buy you guys out or taking it public. Mm-hmm. But number two is why this is so important, is that the public markets reward brand tribalism.
Yeah.
Big time.
True.
Yep. Like, so, you said, Lululemon.
Yep. Huge. So yes. So what in the private markets, so what we call venture capital and private equity, mm-hmm. they're not seeing that, because what they're doing is they're taking companies, they're investing, and they're selling it for 3x on multiple on revenue to GE, to General Mills, to this. And if you go look at all these shitty fucking food manufacturing companies, they're all trading at 1 to 1.5 times revenue. Uh-huh. No tribalism, no brand enthusiasm, yeah, no, declining everything.
Yeah.
So the private markets in this mindset, oh, we invest in companies and we sell them at 3x to the companies that are dying in the public market. Now, we did this exercise where we pulled up all the food manufacturing companies, and then we just started listing all the companies that were relatable. The second you walk into companies that have tribalism, you start at 6 multiple on revenue, all the way up to 20.
That's a lot.
100%.
So,
11.9.
Just like Tesla. Look at Tesla.
They're
a tribe.
I agree.
Right. Yeah.
And I didn't even want to bring that up because I didn't want people to get angry at us. So I tried to even go... I try to be realistic, because if we really get crazy past the 20 multiples, there's tribal companies that are running at 100 multiple on revenue. But I didn't want our investors to look at us like we're fucking whack jobs, because the second you start comparing yourself to Elon Musk, there's a lot of eyebrows.
We're not there.
Yeah.
It's tough.
So, I mean, it's just obvious that I think what we said to all the investors is, look at, why do you love Midday Squares? Because of the tribalism. But then when you want to evaluate us, you want to take out the tribalism. Mm. So you want to have your cake and you want to eat it too. That's just not the reality. And so the only way we're going to be able to provide shareholder value at its maximum capacity is to be a public company, if we're going to continue to invest in the storytelling that Midday Squares does.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's cool, really fascinating. Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
It's different.
It's just is.
Really cool. He woke us up to it. One day he came in. He, there was a stressful moment. I remember he came in with this fucking presentation with this, this table. He's like, read it, and then let's have a conversation, but just read it. And it takes her a lot longer to read than I do. So I read it, and then it all clicked. And it's like, yeah, we're taking it makes sense to take this company public. Stock market, like, what the fuck? And then it took her a little longer to process, but you then agreed as well.
Yeah.
So first principles thinking.
You guys are all about family, and Leslie, you mentioned you're trying to grow your podcast. And from my experience, podcast is by far the best way to grow a relationship with your audience, your customers. You know, you actually get people into your story, they listen to your voice. So where can people find the Midday Square podcast?
So if you go to our website, www.middaysquares.com/podcast, you'll see a lot of information on the podcast there. But we're on Spotify, Apple.
Everywhere. We're syndicated on all the platforms that you can get podcasts on. And it's Midday Squares Uncensored.
And what's the second best place people can find you?
Instagram at Midday Squares. Our Instagram is everything. Yeah.
And if any students are interested in like internships, some engineering students, would you be open to that?
Yes, they can email at goodvibes at middaysquares.com.
Maybe.
So
whenever they want. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, we're always looking for hyper intelligent people.
Yeah. And if you have something to bring to the table, you should email goodvibes at middaysquares.com.
Yeah, I love it.
Even
if we're not hiring, like
don't
be scared. Just come.
Get your foot in the door.
Yes,
that's what I believe in.
Sorry, yeah. I did it again.
So you have been for the last 10 minutes banging on the table.
Yeah, like it's a lot.
Like,
but it means he's excited.
Jake, I've been watching the hands the entire time.
Yeah.
So no, what I wanted to say is, people should remember in life, don't wait for an opportunity to open up. Go get what you want, and if you know what's up, and you believe in yourself, and you're confident, come to Midday Squares and help us build the next
biggest chocolate snack company
in the world.
Awesome.
Shout out to Sophia, who's one of our sales reps. She's a retail manager. She did exactly that. She bulldozed her way into Midday Squares. She was just like, I'm coming to work there. I'm like, we don't have a spot. She's like, I don't care. I'm like, well, I don't know what to tell you. Like, we're not, like, this is a conversation we have to have in November, because it was going into the summer. And she was living in Toronto. And she's just like, I'm coming to live in Montreal. I'm packing my car. And she just did it. She just bulldozed her way into Midday Square.
That's amazing.
And she was hired.
You made room for it.
Yeah, and she's killing it. And so, like, really, if you believe you could come help us on our journey, just fucking
It's everyone's journey, though.
Yeah.
You know, I think you said shareholders is something I like to change to share owners.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, I know. I agree with that.
Yeah, like, this was awesome.
Yeah.
This was awesome.
Thanks for coming.
Hey, Worldwide Engineers. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you've been enjoying the podcast so far and want more, please share this podcast with a friend for two reasons. Number one, by sharing the podcast with a friend, you're going to have someone with who you can discuss the content of this podcast, which will in turn increase the retention of the information you're going to be learning here. And second is, by growing this podcast together, it's going to allow us to bring you bigger and better speakers from who you can learn from. Our goal is to have the world's leading experts come here and share information you wouldn't be able to listen anywhere else. I appreciate you for being here, and I'm going to see you on the next episode.